This week on Behind the Lens, New Orleans City Council orders a moratorium on energy cutoffs as residents struggle through the pandemic. A new report from educators shows reported child abuse cases are down, but there are plenty of questions about that data. Also, Dr. Mark Allen Derry and journalist Leslie Carde discuss the risks posed during phase one of reopening and lingering questions about COVID-19. And we continue to support local music during the emergency. Jillian Goods joins us for a candid interview. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by community support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. We welcome listeners on our partner radio stations, 90.3 FM WAMF LP and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. Entergy New Orleans has pledged to suspend service disconnections until May 31st, but the City Council of New Orleans on Thursday not only extended that moratorium, it changed it from an informal assurance to an enforceable regulation. That's the word from our own Michael Isaac Stein, who monitored Thursday's developments.
So far in the coronavirus crisis, the New Orleans City Council, which regulates Entergy New Orleans, they actually haven't passed, until today, any formal regulations, any formal consumer protections related to electricity service. The council voted to suspend all service shutoffs, so all disconnections from electricity, until July 1st, obviously related to the coronavirus crisis and the economic crisis that is hitting the city hard. And it's pretty significant. As it stood before, Entergy had voluntarily committed to not shutting off anyone's service until May 31st. But today not only extends that order, but it also makes it more formally enforceable as an actual regulation rather than an informal assurance. I should also mention that the council, and in particular council member Helena Moreno, who is the chair of the utility committee, made it clear that just because they're setting this July 1st date does not mean that it couldn't be extended. In fact, it sounded like they might be anticipating some further extensions on that as well.
Just to clarify, because the New Orleans City Council essentially is the regulating body for Entergy New Orleans, do we expect any opposition from that utility?
I'm not sure if we expect opposition. There are similar orders going on all around the country and even, you know, in Louisiana. But yeah, like you said, what you're saying is absolutely correct. This is actually a pretty unique power that our local city council has. Most cities rely on state public service commissions to regulate utilities for them. Again, New Orleans is in a fairly unique position in that it gets to regulate it on its own. And like you said, these are legally binding. New Orleans City Council has the absolute authority to dictate this.
And I understand the city council also had discussions on another measure for electricity consumers. Tell me about that.
As they were talking about the moratorium resolution, Councilmember Helena Moreno made it clear that while it was an important step, it was not the last consumer protection or aid they were going to have to put forward for New Orleans electricity customers. And so she announced, this isn't official yet, but she announced the council's intention to set up a program called the City Council Cares Program. And that would direct Entergy New Orleans to set aside $22 million for bill assistance credits. This would be available, it appears. And again, we don't have the final language of this yet. We're being told that in 2 weeks at the next full city council meeting is when we'll actually, you know, have this discussion vote and we'll be able to see the whole thing. But for now, the details that we have is that it should be available to anyone who's gotten unemployment benefits, during the coronavirus crisis. Now, while the program has not been finalized yet nor voted on yet, what Moreno told us on Thursday is that the program is going to be handing out a maximum of $400 in bill assistance credits spread out over 4 months. So a maximum of $100 per month. it will be available. We're told to anyone who is currently on unemployment benefits or has received unemployment benefits during the coronavirus crisis. So basically, starting at the beginning of April to now, if you have gotten unemployment benefits, you would be eligible for this. And we're also told it could reach upwards of 50,000 households in the city. So some pretty significant stuff, but again, it still has to be passed, and that's what we'll be looking for 2 weeks from now.
And all of that is really good from a consumer's perspective, Michael, but I'm not sure it will do much for the gaping hole that city budget makers are looking at in their work as a result of the pandemic and its associated economic fallout. So what are some of the discussions among city leaders as far as dealing with what are projected to be some pretty gaping issues with revenue?
Yeah, so we had previously reported that the city was expecting anywhere from $130 million to $170 million budget shortfall this year. And that's largely due to reduced sales tax collections. You know, businesses aren't open, tourists aren't coming here. So those things have just dropped precipitously since this all started. You know, when they kind of made that projection towards the end of April, the Cantrell administration requested that all department heads and heads of various agencies and public bodies under control of the city government, it basically directed them to submit budget reduction plans. So basically, you know, asking them to look at their own budget. What can you lose? How can you trim your own budget? They didn't set any specific goals, but they basically asked people to, you know, kind of do their best at, you know, what could you live without? So we got access to those plans. 35 of those plans. There were some missing, but we got access to a good amount of those documents, and we were able to look through what was being suggested. And it's a pretty wide range with some fairly radical ideas. Some department heads are recommending layoffs or furloughs. The Department of Sanitation is put up as a prospect of canceling curbside recycling for now. Something that's been discussed publicly, but, you know, was also in these documents, is reducing trash pickups citywide from 2 days a week to 1 day a week. So there was a wide variety of ideas put out there. But again, a lot of them are things that, you know, 5 months ago, you know, we wouldn't imagine that we'd be cutting right now.
Michael Isaac Stein, following city politics and governance in New Orleans. And we thank you yet again, Michael.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Reports of suspected child abuse in our state have dropped by almost 50% compared to the same time last year. That's according to data from the State Department of Children and Family Services. The drop came as schools shut down for 2 months and students left classrooms for home studies. As Marta Jusen explains, there's concern that these data are not painting the complete picture.
We checked in with the Department of Children and Family Services, also called DCFS, because we wanted to see what child abuse reports were looking like, those initial reports that come in that someone suspects child abuse. Because as we know, schools have been closed for 2 months, and we also have added stress of a pandemic. So, well, you'd think these reports might be increasing due to that added stress, which we know can cause abuse rates and domestic violence to go up. They, in fact, are decreasing, and they've decreased by 50%.
So if the reports are decreasing, that doesn't necessarily mean there's been a decline in cases, but rather a decline in the numbers of reported cases, correct?
Correct. So that's just the number of reports, and not all those reports result in investigations. So when we talked to DCFS, they said during this time period last year, from mid-March to mid-May, they had just over 10,000 reports of suspected child abuse. In that same time period this year, they had just over 5,000 reports. And likely a big part of that is the fact that students had not been in school over that time period. DCFS said it's not unexpected for these numbers to go down when kids aren't in school, but that, you know, they are concerned that the stress of this pandemic could, in fact, be causing cases to go up. So one of the reasons that these numbers are have dropped so much is because school staff, like teachers and counselors, are considered mandatory reporters, which means that they suspect child abuse, they have a legal obligation to report that to the state.
So if the kids are not in class, to be seen by teachers and other mandatory reporters, the caseload is going to drop.
Right. They're basically just making contact with much fewer mandatory reporters, and then also just, you know, you're not seeing as many family members, you're not seeing as many friends. Basically, essentially, there are fewer eyes, you know, on kids and other, you know, family members, and really just our community in general.
And it's been noted elsewhere in the news media that the more people feel like they are confined at home and unable to escape an abusive situation, they're much less likely to report that situation as well.
Right. And I spoke to a counselor who spoke a little bit about that with me. You know, adding in the fact that while her group, communities, and schools is still providing counseling and teletherapy to students, sometimes students don't even have a safe room, you know, in a house where they can talk about everything that's going on in their lives. If, you know, they don't have their own bedroom or just don't have exactly a quiet space.
I know you're also following the race to replace one of the members of the Orleans Parish School Board. Tell me about that.
Right. So Ben Cleven, one of the board members, is resigning, and that is going to take effect in mid-June. So there are three different candidates, or, you know, they're probably not technically candidates, but there are three different people who are interested in taking over his seat. So we have Grisella Jackson, who is a board member of New Orleans College Prep, business owner, and just longtime community member who grew up in the school system here. And we also have Jonas Chartok, who is the former leader of Leading Educators, which is a local group that helps provide professional development to teachers and other professionals in schools. He's also was a teacher for a small stint and has some other experience in education and nonprofits. And then finally, we have Katie Bowden, I'm sure I said her name wrong. She is currently a city council staffer with experience in Medicaid policy. And those are the three folks who are interested. So what we don't know a lot about is exactly how this process is going to go. More than likely, the board will discuss these members at their next meeting, which is in early June. I believe it's like June 8th. From there, they would vote on a new member. And so we'll likely learn a lot more about that at those meetings.
Marta Jusen, reporting on education in the city of New Orleans. Thank you, Marta.
Thank you.
Much more information on this story and resources in Marta's report at thelensnola.org. If you suspect a child in Louisiana is being abused or neglected, call the state's child abuse hotline at 1-855-452-5437. Again, 1-855-452-5437. Dr. Mark Allen Derry is our go-to for medical information on the COVID-19 emergency. He's a good one for it. Mark Allen is an infectious diseases specialist with Access Health Louisiana. He also served on the mayor's public health working group, which had an advisory role in putting together the city's phase one restrictions.
When you look at what the city did was, was following models that were already in existence, you know, and I think that we may have talked about this before, that one of the major issues with COVID-19 happening right now in 2020 is that there has been no centralized response. Cities, mayors, and 50 governors had to eventually figure out how they were going to do it on their own. And so what really is happening is this hodgepodge of different opening criteria. What the city did, I thought, was very good in how they went about it in a very methodical way. And so the first thing was they were going to hit some very key milestones. So milestone number one was they wanted to make sure that there was a 14 days decline in new cases. And so at the time that we opened, there had already been 21 days of a sustained decline.
Right.
So again, they wanted to see 14 days of declined cases. They opened at 21 days. So that's great. So milestone two, that's very important, is testing. In fact, it's related to milestone one. We have to make sure we are testing a number of people. At the time that we reopened, milestone number two was making sure we had testing capacity in place. And we do. And the idea was that we need to at least have 500 tests a day to be able to successfully reopen the city. And they had far exceeded that milestone. So we were doing far more than 500 tests a day. You want to be able to capture those asymptomatics and those pre-symptomatics. Milestone three is making sure that contact tracing was locked and loaded. That is without question the most important thing, because moving forward, we may have talked about this on the last time, was that test, trace, isolate is one of the major foundations by which we are going to limit these ongoing waves as we move forward with COVID-19. To do successful tracing, you need to have contact tracers. Now, unfortunately, when you look at compared to other countries, especially some of the other Asian countries that have had recent respiratory outbreaks or epidemics like SARS or MERS or avian influenza, H5N1 or H1N1, when you look at those countries, they already had a public health infrastructure in place. And with that came contact tracing. And they also were able to implement almost immediately digital contact tracing. So they were able to use apps to immediately allow for people to be pinged if they were near somebody or they were in a close proximity from somebody that had been tested positive. And so those Now, I'm going to totally stay away from all the issues of privacy and all the issues that go down in that direction.
That's another podcast, right?
Yeah, that's another podcast. That's another conversation. But those tools are very helpful, just strictly speaking from a public health perspective. So
sure.
In some of these Asian countries, certainly South Korea, which has multiple apps, and they've done an excellent job of being able to contact trace. What happened here in the U.S. is because our public health infrastructure was not nearly as good as it could have been in the context of what we are seeing with COVID-19. Now we are again somewhat behind the curve or behind the eight ball, and that we need to be building up significant amounts of contact tracers, so that once a cluster of cases are identified or cases are identified, you can deploy contact tracers out into certain locales or what have you, so that they can start to figure out what and where these cases are coming from. These contact tracers can be, folks that are, maybe service industry folks, people who work at restaurants, bars, or even college students can learn the basics of contact tracing and can help significantly identify where clusters of cases are originating. So then at step three, we can get them isolated and then they can maintain isolation. And that's super important. Now, the last milestone that needed to occur was milestone four, which was hospital capacity. And at that point, we recognized that, of course, we were way behind the peak of the curve. And so there was a significant amount of hospital capacity when you were looking at both ICU beds and when you're looking at ventilator availability as well.
I want to ask you from the perspective of an individual doctor trained to respond to infectious disease outbreaks. What... Given the rationales for developing these guidelines as they stand today in the city of New Orleans, what is your concern from a physician standpoint about where we as a community are going with this particular pandemic, given that it's still here and there is still no vaccine?
So let me be very clear that I am speaking on behalf of myself, Mark Allen Derry, or certainly Dr. Derry. In no way am I speaking on behalf of the advisory panel, the public health working group, or anything along those lines.
Understood.
I want to be very clear. I recognize that reopening is a important part of the machinery of this city. There's no question about that. This city actually really functions as a hub for tourists, for entertainment. We have world class eating establishments, world class music establishments. Our musicians here are world class. There's no question about that. So is the entertainment that we have here, and all of the things into the bartenders who make amazing cocktails, what have you. I recognize that. I am particularly concerned, and again, I'm speaking as an infectious diseases physician. We are seeing more and more information, and this week we saw a significant amount of information that was very clear that being in confined spaces and speaking, and even speaking loudly, there will be a distribution of droplets that emanates from a person's mouth that carries the virus. And so for me, it's very hard to imagine being in a restaurant or some other confined spaces where people aren't wearing masks. Now, it's very hard to wear masks when you are eating. Now, I understand that there's the space is amazing. Of course, there needs to be that 6 feet space that's apart. But I am still concerned that we are not necessarily at a point, despite, again, the city made all of they met their milestones. They did everything the way that they said they were going to do. They met all their milestones, and we've been doing great, and I've been incredibly impressed with how the city has been going about things and certainly how the health department has been going about things, and they've been incredibly transparent with how they are going about things. But just as an infectious diseases doctor, I am seeing other cities having issues where cases are starting to go up that have opened. I'm seeing other countries that are starting to, where cases are going up that have opened. And so there needs to be a balance, and I don't know where that balance is. Of course, none of us have ever gone through anything like this. Of course, the last time this happened was in 1918. So to answer your question, Tom, I am concerned, but I also have a lot of trust and faith in the system that should cases start going back up again, that we will respond immediately to it. And again, I'm speaking on behalf of myself. So when I say we, I mean the collective we as the city of New Orleans will respond quickly to it by making sure that we ensure the safety of our citizens of New Orleans.
There are absolutely a lot of people still out there, even in New Orleans, even in the South Louisiana area, who were never really sold on the importance of social distancing, masking, et cetera, sending people home to work, that sort of thing, and have certainly not been convinced in a lot of cases because they don't see the people in their lives suffering so badly. Whether they're just regular people or business owners or whatnot, some have simply all this time not gotten the message of what it means to keep yourself and your neighbors, your friends, your family safe. What words might you offer this last clutch of people?
It's a good question, Tom, and it's a difficult one to answer because if I had the opportunity to speak directly to these individuals. I would be very clear and use the science that we are aware of. And it seems as though that these are individuals that hear and see the science. And I think to a certain degree, there are those that it seems as though that kind of maybe either reject or don't acknowledge it to begin with. And I'll give you an example of that, of how that has hurt some of our rural areas. And there was a great study that came out last week that used cell phone tracking data. And it's anonymized data, so this is not, nobody is being identified. And so what this study did is they were able to look at these protests that happened about a week and a half ago or so, that we may have seen that happened in capital cities around the country. And what they found was that the folks that were clustered in these capital cities, they were able to track and at these protests, right? And what they were able to do is they were able to track out where they went. They found that these folks went to, you know, they traveled several hundred miles, even some of them even traveled across state lines to engage in these protests to reopen their cities or to reopen their states or what have you. And what happened about 10 to 15 days, which is, you know, within the 14-day incubation period of the virus, was that the areas where these people came from started to become hotspots. They started to, so these rural areas started to have increases in cases. And there's no question that when, you know, you had folks that I think they gathered in Michigan and in Lansing and in Denver and these different capital cities of these different states, we all saw the images of these folks that they were clustered together. Nobody was wearing masks. There was no social distancing. And so what happened was that there's no question that there was these asymptomatics that we talked about, and these pre-symptomatics. These are people who are going to develop symptoms later, but before they develop the symptoms, they're highly infectious. And so, and again, we now know it's not necessarily by touching or contact. It's mostly by breathing. It's by talking. It's not even loudly singing or coughing or sneezing. We know that that's definitely. But what we're seeing now, and again, this was an article that came out in the proceedings that came out today. It came out today that just showed that just simple talking, and especially loud talking, where you are going to have larger projectiles of droplets that are going to leave your mouth. And so you have, you know, at some point, 1,500 of these protesters all gathered together, no social distancing, and then they went out into their rural areas where they came from. Now you're seeing pockets of infections. The rural areas are particularly vulnerable. Now, of course, so is New York City and New Orleans and Chicago. Of course, these are cities that have marginalized communities. These are issues that have to do with structural discrimination, both in medicine and in society, that have gone on for decades, if not centuries. But when you get out to the rural areas, you are looking at another type of structural discrimination. So you have hospitals that have left these rural areas because we have a system of medicine that's based on profits. And if bottom lines aren't being met, it doesn't make sense for hospitals to continue to exist. You have folks that tend to be a little bit older, that tend to have more healthcare problems, especially the sorts of chronic health issues that make you more susceptible to COVID-19, like obesity and diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And you also have people who are at the lower rungs of the socioeconomic scale. And so that is a potential, and I use this word in quotes, perfect storm that could potentially be happening in the rural areas. And so what would I tell folks, especially these folks, that I can't underscore the importance of wearing masks. Mask wearing for everybody is the most important thing, because now that we realize, again, the CDC released some data this week that says that contact and surfaces and touching is not a major way of transmission. It's likely a very minimal way of transmission, but not the overwhelming way. So it's still important to disinfect. It's still important to wash your hands. There's no question that the respiratory route, so what is ejected out of your mouth as you're speaking, is far and away the most important transmission vehicle for this virus. Your mouth spittle is captured in that mask. And so when you hear people say, I protect you and you protect me, what they're saying is that when I wear a mask, I'm protecting you from my potential asymptomatic transmission or my pre-symptomatic transmission. And when they say you protect me, that means that when you're wearing a mask, you're protecting me from your potential asymptomatic transmission and your potential pre-symptomatic transmission. And in some way that is beyond me, somehow masks and not wearing masks has become kind of a symbol of resistance, shall we say? And it doesn't make sense to me. And I think it's just a incomplete understanding of the science that exists behind this particular pandemic.
Our thanks to Dr. Mark Allen Derry. You're listening to Behind the Lens on podcast app, our website, or one of our partner radio stations, 102.3 FM WHIV LP and 90.3 FM WAMF LP, New Orleans. We're sure glad to have you with us.
I'm Charles Maldonado, editor of The Lens. We're committed to covering the COVID-19 crisis here in South Louisiana, but we can't do this work without your continued support for nonprofit news. Learn about ways you can help us keep the lights on at our website. It's thelensnola.org/donate. The Lens is your newsroom, and we thank you.
It's Behind the Lens, a podcast by the lensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright.
We really strongly believe that the Convention Center Authority has an obligation to take care of us and to release that money.
A bit of news from the French Quarter this week. The GNO Coalition for a Fair Hospitality Fund organized protests Friday outside Galatoire's restaurant on Bourbon Street. This comes ahead of a planned meeting next week of the Convention Center Board. I spoke with some of those protesters midday Friday, and I do want to note we all, protesters and reporters alike, observed masking and social distancing guidelines.
My name's Emmanuel Segura. I'm with Unite Here, Local 23. It's the hospitality union. And yeah, we're out here, part of this greater coalition, the Greater New Orleans Fair Hospitality Fund. We're here because the Convention Center has over $200 million in cash reserves that is tax funded by food and beverage taxes in the city, by hotel and motel occupancy tax. So in a really real way, hospitality workers made that money. And of course, we all know that the city runs off of tourism and hospitality, and it's known throughout the entire planet for our hospitality and our love of culture. So we know that, you know, this virus has completely decimated our industries.
They picked Galatoire's in part because the restaurant's president, Melvin Rodrigue, sits on the Convention Center's board. We spoke with Dr. Derry earlier, but he's not the only medical professional sounding the alarm about masking and other critical self-protections against coronavirus. Health journalist Leslie Carday spoke with us earlier in the week. She has more on doctors' concerns as the state slowly reopens.
Last Friday, I did a piece taking a look at all the factors involved. Well, we have different rules depending upon what parish you're in. So I tried to look at both Orleans and Jefferson Parish, which have Orleans right now is the most stringent in terms of requirements for opening in phase one. But taking everything into consideration, whether you're a fitness center or a hair salon or a nail salon, tattoo parlors, for example, are not open in Orleans Parish. But looking at all of those factors, we did some research into how far apart you need to be from somebody, for how much time, whether you have barriers on like a mask or plexiglass in front of you. I mean, as you can see, there are a wide range of variables here. And there were interesting studies done as well to show what's going on with businesses. As you know, Texas opened a week before everybody else. So Mark Cuban did a study just to secretly monitor some of those Dallas businesses that had opened. And it wasn't what I would call really anything that any of us would be proud of if we were businesses. No, in fact, it was downright scary because let's face it, if you and I or you or I walk into a business, we expect that they've taken certain precautions, whether it's putting tape on the floor or whether it's seating tables far enough apart from each other or the fact that their employees are wearing masks, et cetera, et cetera. So he found in his secret study of 300 different businesses with his secret folks going in there that only 60% of the businesses met any mandatory kind of protocols. That was in restaurants. And 54% of the suggested ones, that would be like a mask, because most people haven't mandated them like Orleans Parish has here. They have suggested it. Now, I can tell you from walking in places over the weekend and yesterday that in Orleans Parish, I don't care what mandates are out there, I counted between 50 and 60% of people actually wearing masks in spite of LaToya Cantrell's mandate. So without enforcement, that's another whole issue, which means that the onus falls on you. When you walk into a store or a restaurant, you have to look around and decide, are these tables spaced properly? Am I being protected by others wearing masks? And is anybody actually monitoring the room capacity here? So those are all things that fall to us to check. Otherwise, if you see that everything is wrong when you walk in someplace, the best thing to do is walk out.
We've come to view this this virus as something spread through droplets that may spread through contact, the virus itself. But aerosolized particles are another issue that is really rising to the fore of the discussion in the scientific community, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, initially, everybody told us this virus probably wasn't aerosolized as it came out of people's mouths. Over time, well, with the Washington Choir, we found out that certainly wasn't the case. Those people were 6 to 12 inches apart, singing for a couple of hours together. One person turned out to be infected with COVID-19, and he infected 52 others. So they think that, number one, he was probably what they call a super shedder or super spreader, which means what's coming out of his mouth may be more potent than normal. But nevertheless, he managed to have whatever came out of his mouth probably become aerosolized and hung in the air there for probably 6 to 12 minutes. Well, as you can imagine, with people moving around, they moved right into the stream of where this was hanging like a cloud over all of them and inhaled it, either their noses or their mouths. So now we're really extremely concerned because we're starting to realize that even normal speech, let's forget singing for a moment, normal speech causes some of the same issues because droplets, the whole 6 foot thing, Tom, came from the fact that droplets usually within a few seconds come out of your mouth and drop to the floor within 6 feet of the individual. But now that we know it can spread a lot further than 6 feet and also can be aerosolized and hang in the air for many, many, many minutes, that makes it all that much more dangerous. So what we don't know sometimes hurts us. And we're learning more each day because we collect data.
I'd also suggest that what we think we know can hurt us. The notion of herd immunity is one of those things. Talk about how long, remind us for one thing of what herd immunity is and tell us how long that practically speaking it could take to reach it.
Yeah. All right. So let's go over this. Herd immunity starts at about 68%, which means 68% of the population you're dealing with in your area has been infected already. So you have a whole herd of people that have become immune. We don't know for how long, mind you, because once you've been exposed to this virus, you have some sort of immunity. They just don't know how strong it is and for how long it lasts. But all right, let's assume you have some immunity. The virus can't exist when it gets to like 70% herd immunity because there's no place left for it to go. Too many people already have antibodies against it and have formed some kind of immunity. But waiting to have that happen, for instance, let's take Sweden, who has really never locked anything down. They have still not reached herd immunity, and they have oodles of people dying in the process of trying to get there. So whether that's a wise idea or not remains to be seen. And as Joe Cantor pointed out to me, while you're waiting for herd immunity, that means that you're really not locking anything down. You're just letting people out there and they will do what they want to do. If they want to go into a bar that's 8 deep, well, that's what they're going to do without masks on. All right. So, but that could take 6 months to a year without anybody shutting anything down. And the worst part of this, as he was explaining to me, is that while you're waiting for herd immunity, more and more people are getting sick, critically ill, and they're overwhelming hospitals. Now, you are driving down the road and somebody hits you in a car accident. You go to the emergency room and there's nobody to take care of you because the hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID-19. So that's the danger of trying to get herd immunity. There are a lot of hurdles you've got to cross, a lot of deaths you will incur, and you will overwhelm the healthcare workers in the hospitals. Because there are some people, Tom, who think that they are strong and they will survive. And what they're forgetting about when they walk into a store without a mask on is that they're contaminating other people who may bring it home to somebody who is immune compromised and they'll die. So it's, you know, this is all about being considerate and thinking about the health of the public in general, not just about you, the individual.
Something that you mentioned and you have mentioned in your reporting is that masking and other personal protective measures have become political. It's no longer a question of doctor's orders, is it?
Well, you know, I think when you have things coming from on high, whether it's I'm not going to wear a mask or I'm taking hydroxychloroquine or whatever it is that flies in the face of science and public health officials, what happens is you affect people out there who are listening to this, and then they say to themselves, well, I don't need to wear a mask. I mean, let the chips fall where they may. But unfortunately, we're endangering everybody. And I think when Susan Hasek said to me, that's, you know, the epidemiologist at Tulane, said if I had three words for anybody, it would be mask, 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 because that's what prevents you from infecting. You know, I mean, if you don't protect others from you, then what can you expect out there? I mean, it's a matter of consideration and public health. She said to me, this isn't politics, it's public health. We need to stop politicizing this because that's not what should be happening here.
We leave it there for now. Leslie Carday reporting on health and medical issues amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Leslie, thank you so much. Best to you and your family.
Thank you, Tom. Same to you.
This week, we continue our series on local musicians struggling amid the COVID-19 closures in partnership with NewOrleansLocal.com. Jillian Goods is one of those players. The singer-songwriter is not originally from New Orleans, no, but she has a long history with this place, and she finds herself with the rest of our musical community, wondering what's next.
Yeah, I'm from Newark, Delaware. I was there till I was like 22. And then I went on this whole thing of like just trying to travel around everywhere, and I moved out to Yellowstone, and then I lived up in Alaska and Colorado, and I live here now. I've kind of like been all over for the past like 6 years. Yeah, I was on a road trip and I saw these people playing music on the street and just really fell in love with all the There's just so much music here, and I didn't really know that I wanted to be involved in music totally. And then I came through here, and I'm like, I'm going to be a musician. And I went and bought a guitar and then started playing within like that year. But I lived other places and then came back down and lived in a van. That was my introduction to the city, was living in a van. So it was fun. Well, first, I came here right after Katrina, and I was helping clean up, but I was, like, pretty young. And then I came back after I was 21 in 2015, I think, and then I came back in 2016. and have been living here off and on since then.
In terms of breaking into the music scene here in New Orleans, tell me what that's about.
Well, I think when I first came down, I was really intimidated by it because I really wanted to do it, but I didn't have total like musical confidence in myself yet because I wasn't like really good at guitar yet. So I was just going to a lot of open mics and I was meeting people that way, but I didn't really start performing until like a few years into it. So the first few weeks I was really anxious, honestly. I was trying to convince myself to do it, so I got a ticket to Voodoo Fest because I was nervous I was gonna not come to New Orleans because I was scared. And yeah, so I like made myself come and I didn't know anybody yet. I was just really nervous. I was super, super nervous. I didn't know what I was doing. I had like little to no confidence in myself and was just like, I'm here, I'm doing it. I don't know what I'm doing.
That's a heck of a jump, a leap in faith in terms of deciding to pitch a tent here, you know, in New Orleans, in a very competitive music scene.
I enjoy the freedom of the music scene down here. It's just kind of everywhere. You can't ignore it. And I feel like when I go to New York, if I don't know someone or if I don't have like a plan, I might not find the music scene as easily. But here it's just like in your face, all over the place. So it is, as far as like surrounding yourself with a culture to learn something, I felt like that was, if I wanted to learn music, I should come to a place where it's so freely expressed all over the place, and where I can't get away from it. Because I still get like a little like anxiety sometimes performing because I'm still like newer. But then I walk out my door and someone's playing music and they're like, let's jam, come play music, come sing, and always down to do all these cool forms of expression. So it's, I think here, yeah, it's just, you can't avoid it. Told that I have a very bluesy voice, so as far as like, I don't know, some genre of blues, because I know I don't fit right into blues. It's interesting, like last time I went to Delaware, my mom found this New Orleans style blues jam in Delaware City that I had no idea existed, and it's at this little corner store. You wouldn't think that it would be anything there really, yeah. But it was really cool. I went home last time and I actually like sat in on a like blues jam. So new doors have been opening in Delaware actually since I've started doing music. I feel like my whole life has changed since I've started doing music. But yeah, if I were to describe it, I would definitely say some kind of blues. And like, I don't know, I get also told like it's kind of gypsy-esque, but also folk because of my topic of writing as far as like being on the road kind of things. So yeah, gypsy blues folk.
And I can understand that given that an acoustic guitar lends itself well to all three of those genres. Your voice is clearly capable of carrying all three genres. Did you have any musical training? I know you're relatively new on guitar, but musical training in terms of vocals?
Yeah, so when I was growing up, I went to church and I was in Catholic school also. So I was singing a lot for that purpose. So I was in choir and stuff from when I was really young. I stopped really performing throughout like high school and things until I came back in through New Orleans pretty much. I kind of fallen out of it and didn't get back into like pursuing it on my own.
Now the only thing that ever means is a
I play Apple Barrel once a week, every Friday. And otherwise, nothing was totally regular. But I had gotten myself in playing House of Blues in the Voodoo Garden, and I had a show at Hi Ho, and then there was another one. But it was like I had more gigs coming up than I had had since being back. And then the weekend that it was all supposed to start happening, they were like, okay, actually, we're going to have to, like, postpone this, and I don't know what's going on. So it was kind of this weird, you know, all of a sudden, just, like, nothing. But for a little bit, I guess I would say I had about three to four a week. If I was sitting in with people, I had more. I had background singing with my friend Matt, and it's Dwayne Bartles and the Boys. So yeah, different musical projects. We've been doing some rehearsals. We're recording on the 25th, so we're going to be doing a single called Messin', and then another one that, for some reason, Wildfires. So we're actually are going to be recording on the 25th. So that's exciting to actually have, you know, a set project other than my own self-motivation to find something to do with my life right now. I also did have a job, so I am on unemployment right now, which is nice because I was nervous for a minute. At the same time, though, like, when all this started happening, I was doing these live videos and I was doing, you know, just kind of being like, I can help wherever you need me. And everyone was very open to helping me because so many people were out of work. And I've also been trying to like throw support to people monetarily as well when I can, like in the right situations and stuff. But I really was getting a lot of support even before I started getting unemployment. I was getting support from friends and family and people who believed in my music, and that felt really good. It's also been an interesting change playing music for myself more. Since I'm not going out and playing for audiences, it's kind of brought back the feeling of self-care with music that I feel like I kind of was falling out of for a little bit when I started having a regular thing. Like when I was playing Apple Barrel, it's like I have to feel like performing between 3 and 6 every Friday. I would like make myself do it, and like now I just have all the time to do it whenever I want to, and it's bringing back that magic, would be the right word.
Yeah. And yeah, and certainly if you're able to refocus on creative efforts to, you know, in performance, songwriting, etc. If you can do that and not get distracted by every pandemic development on the news, yeah, yes. It can be rewarding.
I'm not really sure as far as performance-wise, but I mean, I know everything's going to be at 25% capacity, but there's also going to be a balance of people who are like in a rush to get out and like really excited, and then the other people who are way too nervous to leave their house still. So I don't really know where that ratio is going to be. But I feel like there's going to be a lot of really good music being written right now. So we probably would expect a lot of new recordings and new projects and rebirths of music to come out of this. And I mean, in all kinds of art, because it's like you put an artist in a white room with their favorite medium and hopefully they use it, you know? And if they do, then they have all the time to use it.
Jillian Goods, under the handle Jillian K Music on Facebook. Jillian, thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us and perform for us.
Oh, for sure. Cool. Thank you.
Keep up with Jillian Goods on SoundCloud and Facebook. Her handle again is Jillian K Music. JILLIANKIY Music. And that's all for this week. Our reporting is always online at thelensnola.org, free of charge. Thank you very much, but we appreciate your continued support. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind the lens.